This show is powered by BL3P, the Lightning-enabled European Bitcoin exchange.
Connect the build.
Alex Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer, Human Rights Foundation, author, Hidden Repression.
Ice baths, also known as cold water immersion therapy or cryotherapy, are a popular practice among athletes and individuals engaged in physical activities. The concept behind ice baths is to expose the body to extremely cold temperatures, typically ranging from 50 to 59 degrees Fahrenheit for a limited period, usually around 10 to 20 minutes. Do you love to take an ice bath?
Yes.
Death Valley National Park is currently struck by a heat wave. You were there in March this year while it was snowy, which is very, very unusual. Was this the most remarkable experience of that trip?
Yeah.
Cabernet Sauvignon is a red wine grape variety that is widely regarded as one of the most popular and esteemed wine grapes in the world. It is known for producing full-bodied, complex and age-worthy wines. Do you know Cabernet Sauvignon is the most planted wine grape in the world with around 720,000 acres?
Yes.
Have you already started writing your fourth book?
Yes.
The Legend of Zelda is a highly popular and influential video game franchise created by Nintendo. The series was first introduced in 1986 with the release of The Legend of Zelda for the Nintendo Entertainment System and has since become one of Nintendo's most successful and enduring franchises. Does Zelda have a place in your top three best games?
Yes.
Oakland is the most popular city and county seat of Alameda County, California. It is and is known for various things like its great cultural diversity, like Lake Merritt, the port of Auckland. But did you know Auckland is also the place where the Mai Tai cocktail was invented?
Yes.
Have you already started mining using thermal energy from one of the geysers of Calistoga in Napa Valley?
No.
Are you one of the speakers at Bitcoin Amsterdam this year?
No.
Radiohead is an English rock band that emerged in the late 1980s and gained significant acclaim and popularity in the 1990s and beyond. The band is known for their innovative sound, thought-provoking lyrics and genre-bending approach, incorporating elements of alternative rock, art rock, electronic music and experimental sounds. Have you ever had a chance to see them play live?
Yes.
Are you Satoshi Nakamoto?
No.
Welcome to the Connect the World weekly podcast. I'm Edward.
And I'm Steph. We are ready to take you with us into the beautiful world of the Lightning Network.
Enjoy the ride.
This is episode 82 of Connect the World, and this show is made possible by our friends from BL3P, the European Bitcoin Exchange. Thank you guys for helping us out with our mission, and if you also want to help out, then head over to our Twitter account, subscribe at YouTube, or go to our Telegram groups where you can ask us everything you like. And of course, a donation is always welcome. Let's continue with our new guest.
Conecta el mundo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Alex.
Welcome.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hey, I saw on Twitter, I saw you were in ice bath with Robert Breedlove. Where was this photo taken, man? Because you guys seemed to enjoy it. I was like, well, is this the Wim Hof? Wim Hof is a Dutchie, obviously. Are you guys practicing the Wim Hof method or what were you guys doing?
It was actually not planned. My organization, the Human Rights Foundation, runs a conference every year in Oslo called the Oslo Freedom Forum, which is dedicated to promoting human rights globally.
Yeah.
And Robert was a guest at the forum as a journalist. He was interviewing a lot of activists for his show. And on the final day of the event, we used a venue on the fjord in Oslo that was a little bit more of a festival vibe. It was, it had access to the fjord for swimming. It had, you know, drinks, music. There were a lot of live experiences. We had different kind of cool venues for different topics. We had a whole kind of Bitcoin house, and it just was a little bit more informal than the previous 2 days, which are kind of in a theater. It gives guests the ability to kind of relax a little bit after two kind of intense days. And I didn't actually know there was going to be ice baths there. I knew there would be saunas and swimming. And I was walking through the venue, and I saw like one of the ice baths, and I looked to my right, and Robert is like walking towards me with a towel, with no shirt, just hanging out. and I was like, dude, we should go in the ice bath. And yeah, we went in the ice bath. It was fun.
Awesome.
Great. It's a little cold, but it was like, it was very sunny and nice out that day. I think it was hot. It was extremely rare, but it was about 30 degrees in Oslo that day. So it felt really okay. Good.
And did you manage the 10 to 20 minutes or was it shorter?
I think we were in there for probably 10 minutes, but 10 minutes. Okay. It was not the coldest ice bath in the world. so that helped. I can do for maybe 2 or 3 minutes at most. They're,
yeah,
I'm not a big, I mean, it feels good, but it's not something I do on a weekly basis. I mean, I think I've done 4 or 5 this year. Let's put it that way. I don't, it's not something that's in my daily routine.
I only do it when I leave the sauna or something, and then just for a couple of seconds, I mean, just cooling down first. Or I think it's even, I take a cold shower first, because you have to cool the body first, and then the head, and then you have all those ice baths right next to you, and then that's the only way I'm doing my ice baths. But it looks very, in Dutch we say gezellig, very cozy between you. I mean, I don't think I had enough energy left for having a conversation when I'm sitting in the ice bath. But
you need the energy to...
to warm up the body or something.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, and that national park is currently struck by a heat wave.
Yeah.
You were there in March last year, and it was very, very snowy. How was that for you to experience something like that? Because it's very unusual, right?
It was a historic season of snowfall, I was trying to ski in the Sierras, and we had to basically be diverted to the Death Valley National Park area to get to where we were going.
Yeah.
And it was extremely beautiful. I mean, that whole part of the country is very, very pretty. So
yeah.
It's also very, very, very remote, but something, a big experience to drive through, I would say.
Yeah, I can imagine. And but you guys succeeded in, you guys got to the final destination, right? To ski or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Perfect. Okay, cool. Let's, we have all kinds of questions for you about the Human Rights Foundation and, of course, the latest book you wrote. But it has to be in the 21 minutes. So if you're ready for that part,
I'm ready.
Let's enter that part.
Let's do it. All right.
Conectează lumea.
Let's start with the Human Rights Foundation first. How does the Human Rights Foundation assist individuals or communities who are living under authoritarian regimes or facing human rights violations?
Yeah, great question. It's the core mission for us is to support people living under authoritarian regimes. They might be human rights activists. They might be environmentalists, journalists, poets, artists. We have a variety of programs targeted at helping them. Some involve public awareness, so helping them tell their story to the world at events that we produce through the media, through digital. Some of them involve education, training, and skills. So we have fellowships and lots of opportunities for leaders from difficult political environments to upgrade to improve their game, to better understand how to grow organizations, scale movements, raise money, market themselves, build personal leadership and personal health and well-being. Part of that is also financial freedom related. They can learn how to use Bitcoin and how to avoid the banking system, which is important for a lot of them. We have prizes, awards we give out to recognize the work that these folks have done. And, you know, we are just trying to be relentless in pursuit of helping them. There's lots to be done in the West as well, I think, obviously, but we need to recognize that for all the different struggles we're facing, it's just a different architecture for them. They don't have, like, they can't sue their government. They can't, like, vote a new person into power. They can't start a street protest. They can't, you know, mock or make fun of their government on TV or media. It's you know, again, I don't want to downplay the problems of our society, and whether it's the Netherlands or United States, there are lots. But the structure is different in terms of how to actually make a change. Their choices are very minimal. If you're in China or Saudi Arabia, there's not like a whole lot of wiggle room for the public to push back or hold the government accountable. And there's just much more of that in the West, which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there are tons of organizations helping promote human rights in the Netherlands and France and the United States. And there just aren't very many doing it for China, and just very, very few resources, even though it's the world's largest country, as an example. So as an organization, we've chosen to focus our resources and energy on authoritarian regimes, so that currently is 5.8 billion people, or about 72% of the world's population, that live under some kind of authoritarian regime.
And of course, we know that technology can help to promote freedom and counteract oppression. But can you tell us more about the intersection of technology, in this case, Bitcoin and human rights? Why does this go hand in hand?
Well, you know, open source software is a way for people to peacefully and quietly defend themselves, whether it be with encrypted messaging, defending their communications, whether it be by using tools like VPNs or Tor to access information that's been forbidden. Or in the case of Bitcoin, making transactions, saving, doing commerce, paying bills, hiring, and running nonprofits without the state involved. So technology has been instrumental to empower individuals in an age otherwise of just like increasing political control over people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Human Rights Foundation has been a prominent advocate for privacy and freedom in the digital world. You're talking already about also Freedom Forum also. Could you elaborate on why these issues are critical to human rights? So privacy and freedom, of course, people can imagine that, but privacy is a difficult one because it's very different in a lot of countries, and some of the people that are more privileged think privacy is not so important.
Yes, you often get a lot of bad takes from people in the West where they say that privacy is not that important.
Yeah.
Don't be a coward. Don't hide behind a pseudonym on the internet.
Well, I have nothing to hide.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. I mean, obviously, look at... So if Satoshi Nakamoto had used their real name or whatever, they'd be, you know, dead or in prison or whatever. So if you're going to do something dangerous or revolutionary, you need to be quiet about it. Otherwise, you're going to be stopped immediately.
Yeah.
So for software developers or journalists living in difficult places, they often do their work quietly, or they use a pen name. There are a lot of important reasons to retain privacy in that regard. But I mean, essentially, if you don't want to live in a police state where the government is watching everything you do and can like mold and model your behavior by doing social engineering, you need privacy. Like if you don't want to feed like a big brother that's like getting more powerful and knowing everything about its citizenry, and being able to predict what they're going to do next, basically, through AI type software, which is what's happening in China, and also to a different degree happening across the whole world through surveillance capitalism. Mm-hmm. If you don't want that, then you're going to need your transactions to be private.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, ideally both your communications would be private, so that those can't be, like, you know, sifted and analyzed and chronicled and then mapped. But also your transactions. And it's worth remembering that, like, when you pay for something with a note, a bank note, you know, the merchant doesn't know anything about you. They don't know your birthday or where you come from or what you bought last or what your home address is. And that was okay. That was legally, morally, ethically, technologically fine. And now when you pay for something, it's like you swipe and, like, the system knows that it's you, and you have this huge identity stack that's attached to that action. And over time, this can help them map you, locate you, censor you, delete you, blacklist you, whatever, devalue you. So privacy, I think, is kind of goes hand in hand with political and financial freedom.
Yeah.
Can you share with us about a recent initiative or project undertaken by the Human Rights Foundation that you think significantly impacted human rights?
Sure. I mean, we're currently planning a whole bunch of stuff around our work in North Korea. But over the last 5-6 years, we've been able to send more than 100,000 flash drives into North Korea. These are filled with outside information chosen by Koreans, North Koreans and South Koreans. They put all kinds of outside information, basic educational stuff, a lot of culture, cinema, television programs, etc. And then people in North Korea who don't have the internet, you know, they get to learn about this stuff. So mm-hmm. if you consider that each drive, we're kind of, now it's a little different than about 5-6 years ago. Now it's more like smartphones that read little SD cards, things like that. But basically, like, any one piece of equipment is shared by a bunch of people numerous times. So our field research indicates that, like, 100,000 flash drives and pieces of equipment, you know, have probably reached millions of people. So I think we could be pretty proud of that. And you know, what happens next is those people have more agency. They know more about the outside world and they can make their own decisions. Maybe some of them decide to leave North Korea, and we have ways to help them do that and support them when they get to South Korea. Or maybe they decide to start to change the system from the inside a little bit. But like, there's not going to be any change if people are ignorant and don't know. No. So that's something we're quite proud of.
And you mentioned earlier the importance of Bitcoin melting gracefully into future apps, so becoming a infrastructure and not seeing it, but it's there and it works. How can we ensure that the process is inclusive and accessible to everyone, regardless of their technological literacy or access, because there isn't always internet at the place where somebody lives. So
that, yeah, for instance, the people in North Korea.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think what's critical is to get the opinions of a wider group of people, to be diverse. And I know that a lot of people in the Bitcoin community mock this as like a virtue signaling thing, but it's actually very important. Like, if you aren't diverse, okay, then you're not going to know that a lot of people in Africa, for example, don't have a smartphone or don't have internet access on a smartphone, and they cannot use QR code or copy paste. Okay, so how much Bitcoin infrastructure relies on copy paste or QR code? Most, yeah. All, virtually all. Okay, indeed. So Africans had to invent a way of using Bitcoin on a feature phone with alphanumeric, which is relevant for hundreds of millions of people. So people mock diversity, but if you're not diverse in the way that you attack problems, and if you don't try to pull in a diverse group of people to attack problems, a global problem, then you're going to fail. You're only going to be partially successful.
Yeah.
So I think that looking at what folks have done in terms of creating apps that work without internet on feature phones, where you basically SMS a number.
Yeah, like Machankura.
Yeah, and it spits you out, and you know, that's amazing. So that's something that
It is.
You know, you're not going to invent if you live in Silicon Valley. You know,
no, that's
so or in Amsterdam.
Well, it reminds me of the story of a village in Africa where some kid from 7 years or eight tries to think about something, a solution for a solar power or irrigation or water. And this from the inside out seems a lot more difficult because you're talking about technology and it's not available to a lot of people. But if you're talking about solutions like Machankura, well, yeah, that's really what we need. So those are little steps taken.
North Korea fits. Might be the same way. Like we don't quite know yet. Like we're researching. There's a lot of remittances that go into North Korea, like the old school way, with like kind of a hawala type system. The tech is bad. It's not efficient. It's expensive. But one thing that would be very important would be privacy. And, you know, obviously on-chain transactions are not very private. Or at least they reveal, you know, quite a bit about the on-chain activity at the moment. Mm-hmm. Which can be mitigated if you don't attach your real-world identity. And if you use cash. It's not as much of an issue, but for someone living in North Korea who's about to like take a Bitcoin payment, well, all of a sudden privacy is a little more important than maybe somebody in California. So, thinking about how to democratize privacy in Bitcoin is probably important for that use case. They're going to think of clever trade-offs that maybe we wouldn't take, like routing. They may look like we may look at Wallet of Satoshi and be like, that's an unfortunate project because it encourages people to rely on custody. They may look at Wallet of Satoshi and be like, oh, this is great. I'm going to send my Bitcoin to Wallet of Satoshi and then send it to private. Like where it needs to go. And I'm going to get a lot of privacy.
Yeah.
And they basically use it as like a mixer. So, I mean, I don't know, but it needs to be studied. And clearly privacy is more important for Bitcoin use in North Korea than it is, you know, elsewhere.
Yeah, sure. Okay, let's talk about your latest book, man. Hidden Repression: How the IMF and World Bank Sell Exploitation as Development. In this book, you discuss the exploitation and inequities in our societies. Can you elaborate on the specific types of exploitation you have explored?
Well, the thesis is basically that like colonialism is still alive and just in a different form. Old school colonialism, which was the search. You know, largely by European powers, but also by other powers historically, for more resources and cheap labor to grow their core society and do it in a way where they wouldn't have like uprisings at home, required inputs of cheap goods and minerals and resources from elsewhere, as well as cheap labor. If you don't have the cheap labor component, then stuff gets really expensive at home and you have very high inflation. So societies like the British, the Dutch, the Japanese, the French, they would go abroad, you know, over hundreds of years, Spanish, and they would find new, you know, resources, and they would use military force and violence to confiscate that. Gold and silver and oil are good examples, as are, you know, all kinds of other things. But Britain, you know, Britain basically enriched itself by conquering India and taking over India. India was the richest country in the world. And then Britain became the richest country in the world on the back of Indian, you know, resources partially. So, you know, the story of colonialism was like, you know, technologically advanced peoples oppressing less technologically advanced peoples through violence and death and murder and rape and subjugation and slavery to get their stuff. That more or less has ended. There's a lot of debate about that, but you know, 1960s widely regarded as sort of a formal sort of end of colonialism. Obviously that's not entirely true, but it's generally speaking, it's widely accepted as kind of the end. So these Western powers and, you know, including Japan and others, you know, not in Europe, but, you know, people considered part of like, quote unquote, like advanced economies. They kind of had to find a different way of getting all this cheap stuff that they need to keep their society stable. When they don't get that cheap stuff, they have big problems at home. like the Great Depression came at a time when Britain was which was the financial center of the Western world at the time. It was able to loot less rapidly from India. And one of the reasons we had a big crisis was that the conveyor belt of free stuff from India started to slow down. The reason we had so much inflation in the 70s, one of the major reasons is that all this energy that we used to get for very cheap through the Seven Sisters, which were Western companies that controlled oil fields in other places, that got nationalized by local actors. And then those countries now controlled the production of oil, and they decided to raise the price, which caused a lot of inflation in the West. So now you're, so that was essentially like labor and resources in the India case, energy in the case of the 70s. And today it's what's called globalization, which is, of course, again, the relentless quest for cheaper labor and goods to input into our machines, our economic machines.
Yeah.
So now that's breaking down a little, which is going to cause crisis, right? So history rhymes in this way. But basically the thesis of hidden repression is that what Western powers did, you know, maybe not consciously, but like what they did, the outcome's the same, is they used debt colonialism to replace military colonialism. So instead of going into a country and like ransacking it and killing the leadership and installing a puppet and occupying, which is what old they used to do, now they go in and they offer to a local leader who's typically corrupt a large loan to support them. That loan, of course, is predatory. It's very has high interest rate, so they make money on the loan itself. But then also the loan has all kinds of stipulations, conditionalities. And the loan basically forces the leader to shape the country in a way that benefits the creditor nation. This might include like devaluation of wages to make things cheaper for export. Mm-hmm. It might include growing a particular crop or set of crops that we want that are not helpful for the local population, but help us. So this kind of pattern accumulated in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s continues to happen today. And it basically is called, it's also called unequal exchange. It's not the sort of Adam Smith, oh, one country's good at making this and the other country's good at making this and they can trade with each other. No. That's like horribly naive. It's like the major powers control and rig the rules of trade, and they subsidize heavily their own industries. So obviously the Netherlands has done this with farming. It's this tiny little country that has been able to heavily subsidize a lot of agricultural stuff.
I think we are the second largest export country.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of that kind of stuff is only possible because of subsidies in the form of cheap inputs and cheap labor chains and stuff in poor countries. If that wasn't possible, like if the Dutch could not import raw stuff from poor places that didn't have like unions and labor rights and like similar wages,
would be too expensive.
Inflation would be completely insane in the Netherlands. They could not support these programs. So you start to understand that like the social welfare states that we have in the West, and a lot of the innovation and technology that we have as a result of government investment in these areas, whether it's the space race in the United States or whatever, or you could argue like Silicon Valley is subsidized by the government because of the bailouts, right? Like these companies have taken enormous risks and they get basically sterilized. So whatever you want to argue, but like certainly the financial system in the United States is totally juiced up by the government. I mean, that's pretty widely acknowledged. So whether it be in the form of bailouts or government direct investment, or social welfare, or in Britain right now, there's like capped energy price, like whatever, like our governments will go out of their way in the West to like provide free stuff for people to make them happy so that we don't overthrow them. Right. So that, you know, we don't vote for somebody else. Right. Because we have like democracy. Right. OK. Mm. Well, that's again, you start to see that's in many ways only really possible because of the exploitation that we do abroad. So the big question I try to explore in the book, or that I think should leave the reader with at the end, is our way of life possible without exploitation? So that's kind of the thing that I've been thinking about very deeply, which is a tough question because it strikes at the heart of what we know as what we commonly think of as capitalism and all these other things. So I think a big part of the rot is the currency, is the fiat system. So I think in a Bitcoin standard, things would look very different.
Yeah, because fixing the monetary system towards a world where Bitcoin plays a significant role. You talked about in the book that can lead to a societal change, of course. Could you discuss more about how you envision Bitcoin and transforming global
economy? Well, imagine if everybody used the same currency. Yeah. I mean, the playbook of the IMF and the World Bank, which again are these institutions that the creditor nations use to impose their will and enrich themselves abroad, is fiat currency. Like they in Egypt, there's a Egyptian currency that is, a lot of these have closed capital accounts. Like they're kind of like stuck. It's like people are stuck with this currency. It's kind of hard to escape from that currency. There's controls on gold. There's controls on dollars. There's controls on cryptocurrency, you know? They want people to use that local currency because what as a part of the deal with the IMF, what happens is that currency gets devalued. So like, you know, basically it is cheaper for the West to buy Egypt's stuff. Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the person who loses out is the Egyptian people, right? So this is possible because there's a different fiat currency there. Okay. So all of a sudden, let's think about a world where everybody uses the same currency. You know, in a small way, this is like why Egyptians want dollars, because it allows them to, you know, preserve their purchasing power a little bit better. But imagine if everybody was on the same currency. Well, I mean, there would still be rich countries and poor countries, of course, but like the labor arbitrage would be very different. I mean, it starts to get much harder to justify paying people like way less when it's all the same currency. That's an interesting thing. And if it's all a tech, if the world is, you know, increasingly tech oriented and info tech oriented, I mean, a lot of these jobs can be done by people in the global South or developing world. And all of a sudden it's like, well, they're going to get more competitive in terms of what they charge. And a lot of this like system of the world where like people are held down is going to be diffused. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think quite obviously if like we're all on the same money standard, that's clearly better. Like I think that this idea that we should have inferior monies and poor people should have to use them is totally absurd. I would really be excited about debating anybody who would argue that like we should have like 180 different fiat currencies and
everything remains like unequal, right? So yeah.
I mean, it's just like that's a losing argument. So
yeah.
You know, the problem is, money is a technology. Like gold was just not gonna do it. Like it just wasn't good enough for what we needed. And as much as the gold bugs want to say that we need, you know, we'll go back. We're not going back to gold. Gold was inefficient for retail transactions. That's why people invented double entry bookkeeping and all kinds of credit systems and banknotes. And because you couldn't just like carry around your gold and like, and you know, use it as the medium of exchange for stuff. It lost. It has a role, but like it's not going to be the money for the world. Bitcoin, on the other hand, could be. It was invented to basically be better gold. It can teleport, it can easily divide, it can you know, be programmed. I mean, it is so superior in so many ways. It is more scarce. So anyway, excited about that future.
Everyone can mine it. Everyone can verify it.
Every country can issue the reserve currency in a Bitcoin standard by harnessing its own resources. Today, the only way poor countries can get the reserve currency is by selling something to the United States or its allies that we want. So yeah, that element of control gets diffused, and that I think would be big for the world.
Yeah. Well, I think I hear the TikTok, Edward.
Yeah, I hear
think
too.
This is a a great ending to the 21 minutes. I mean, surely some statements to think about.
I think there's a lot of work to do, Steph.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
There is, obviously. But we all do our own part, right?
Yeah, that's
the
true.
Most beautiful thing, I think.
Yeah.
So, well, thanks, Alex.
Yeah, thanks again.
Yeah, we had a lot of more questions, but yeah,
pleasure,
maybe
brother.
We can invite you into a future show to ask you those.
Yeah.
And bear with us because we have a question left.
Conecta el mundo.
Because we are going to play lightning bingo. Well, it isn't a real bingo, but you may choose one question we pre-recorded from people we like from within the lightning space. The people you can choose from are Herman Vivier from Bitcoin Ekasi, Arnold Hubach. He's a fellow Dutchie, a Bitcoin nomad, and he travels through the world through all the Bitcoin circular economies. Or Renata Rodriguez, and she's from Fedimint.
Well, we'll go with Renata.
Hi, this is Renata from Fedi, and I want to know what is the most exotic thing that you have bought with Lightning.
What is the most exotic thing you've bought with, well, Bitcoin, but Lightning, to be specific?
Exotic. Oh, that's exotic. Interesting.
Yeah, you know Renata, right? She's an exotic woman.
Yeah. Well, I mean, probably Salvadoran street food is pretty exotic for me.
Papusa.
In California.
Papusa,
yeah. Yeah, probably was a papusa. I bought some cool stuff with Lightning, but that was probably the most exotic. Yeah.
All right.
Perfect. Thanks.
Conectado Lumen.
Okay, Alex. And we are proud to announce that we have a prize to give away. And yeah, it's a real nice prize. But yeah, you may reveal what prize we can give away.
Yeah, happy to give away an interactive badge for the 2024 Oslo Freedom Forum, which is a human rights conference in Norway that'll take place in June 3 to 5 next year that explores a lot of themes, including art, cinema, breakdowns in global social order, but also for financial freedom. And we have a big Bitcoin track. And we'll give away a ticket, so you'll be able to attend parts of the programming on June 3, 4, and 5 next year.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Okay. What do the guys or girls need to do in order to make chance to win the prize, Edward?
Well, they need to like and retweet the announcement of this episode by our user account on Twitter, CTW Podcast. And subscribe to our channel, of course, and check the show notes for more information about this. So like and retweet the announcement, and then we just pick one out of a hat.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Okay, thanks again, Alex. Where can people find you, man? Where, obviously everyone knows where to find you on Twitter, but maybe you have some other links that you want to share, projects that you working on currently, or anything you want to highlight.
Yeah, well, the Human Rights Foundation has a development fund that funds open source software projects like Bitcoin. We're doing some Nostr work, some other things.
Yeah.
So yeah, check out hrf.org/devfund.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, definitely do that. We talked a lot about some other prominent figures that are working very hard on Nostr and the Lightning Network. Of course, we're following them. So get to the website of HRF and check it out, all those projects. And thanks to everyone else for listening, and to all members participating in our Satoshi Radio Rings of Fire project. And of course, thanks to everyone helping to connect the world with us. So if you like our content, then please support us in our mission. Visit our website, connecttheworld.live, where you can also donate and like, subscribe and share our content on your favorite platform. So remember, we need you to complete our mission. So keep those nodes running, sets flowing, and rings burning. And see you all next week on the same Lightning channel. Tot ziens, Alex.
Tot ziens.